Intellectually, I know that marriage is a place where I need to learn about myself. But when the things that I need to learn about myself are hard to hear, when they're weaknesses or limitations that I have, what I do instead of learning is clench my fist and stamp my feet and say no.
This is Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. What makes a good marriage? What should one's goals be in marriage? In today's program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and professional therapist Christine Barber continue to take a hard look at the big issues of marriage, like forgiveness, pursuing righteousness, and trusting God. The issues don't get any bigger than that. Let's listen to Jack and Christine.
Jack, last week when we finished our taping, I felt kind of a letdown feeling. And what I realized after a little while of thinking about it was that I was sad that we were done for a whole week, that we weren't going to get to come back and talk in this way for a week. And I've really appreciated the opportunity to discover with you and explore with you. And again today, we've just been talking quite a bit. And I'm very thankful for the opportunity to grow up by listening to you and by interacting with you.
Thank you.
I think that there's a lot of growing up that we do in our marriages by listening to and understanding each other, by really being willing to attend to the other person in a uniquely attentive way. Mm-hmm. That's kind of using the same word over again, but I find a great deal of growth in my willingness to be a listener to my husband and in his willingness to be a listener to me. It is a kind of listening that puts aside my own preoccupations for a while. It's not as though I put aside myself. Ultimately, I don't put myself aside, but for a while, I kind of bracket myself and allow myself to hear into what my husband's saying. A very common way of saying that is I walk in his shoes, or I get into his shoes and really understand him from his perspective. Not in a way, not with the intent of changing him, with the intent of understanding who he is, with the intent of not changing him.
On the one hand, it's just at the heart of what a marriage is that we make that commitment to one another, that I make that commitment to my wife. But on the other hand, over the course of time, it really can become a very natural kind of focus, because that woman has become so important to me. I mean, I think you said last week that it's the most important thing in your life, your relationship with your husband. I would say the same thing about my relationship with my wife. There is no gift that God has given me more valuable to me than this relationship. And as you come to appreciate and value more and more that relationship, it really becomes a delight in its own right to be able to shut everything else out and just focus on this person, because this person has become intriguing, this person has become interesting, this person has become valuable to me. Our selfishness, of course, always makes that hard at times. It's never convenient to say no to the other demands in life and focus, but it doesn't have to. It's not exactly it's not a drag either to do that.
I think really learning, though, to listen, certainly initially in our relationship, takes a whole lot of courage, because listening often and hearing another person, I'm often hearing things that are difficult for me to hear. If I listen to my husband, for example, talk about the difficulty it is for him to walk into our house and it's very dirty, and I'm a person who really hasn't disciplined myself to manage the house well, then I want to change him. I want to get on his back. I might get angry as a response so that he'll shut up. So listening requires an incredible extension of myself to go beyond my limits, to not shut him down so that I don't get challenged to look at areas that I need to look at.
It requires that orientation toward the other person that is so foreign to our natural way of thinking, our natural self-centeredness. Marriage is asking me to not be centered on myself, but to be committed to centering on the other person. What's in their best interests? What are their needs? What are their desires? To ask myself to take that into consideration. And it does not come naturally to us.
I think a very difficult thing about listening also, Jack, is that when I listen to somebody, I often think I have to do what they say, and that's not true at all. Or I have to believe what they say, or I have to go along with what they say, or I have to think the way they're thinking. Very often when I'm listening to somebody, it could sound like, am I listening to them? It could sound like I'm going along with them. I think if we're listening well, it may often sound that way as I'm reflecting what they're saying to me and trying to understand it. But I think we can listen better if we go in with the idea that I don't have to become what the person wants me to become. I don't necessarily, in the example I used before, have to become a great housekeeper. But I certainly need to listen to and understand my husband's perspective and his desires and his needs, and take that in as part of what I need to use as information to lead my life in a wise and right way. But it doesn't require that I necessarily be a good housekeeper.
Do you find even the existence of different values and different desires, do you find that threatening? I think that's been my experience, is that, you know, I think I anticipated and expected that this is my wife. We will always be of one mind. We will always see things exactly the same. I mean, at least we can always come to see things the same. And yeah, especially early in my marriage, I think I found it a little bit threatening when she wasn't seeing it the way I was seeing it. She wasn't looking at life in quite exactly the same way. And it took me a while to realize that's okay. I mean, maybe you'll become of one mind over the course of time. As you dialogue, as you talk, as you have conversations, as you influence one another, but you don't have to be there right now. It's enough, it's adequate to just understand, ask questions, listen, focus, concentrate, use your imagination, try to look at life, try to see how it is that she's seeing life, or this situation, or this question, or this problem. And if you can get there, that's enough for now.
You asked me, do I find that threatening that my husband is different than myself? Certainly you're saying that it was threatening for you. Cognitively, in my marriage in the beginning, I would have said absolutely not. I know that my husband is different than me. As different as he and I look physically, he's 6'4", I'm maybe 5'3". Sometimes I lie and say 5'4", but I'm shorter. He's a redhead, I'm a graying brunette. That just we are very different in our looks, and as we are different in our looks, we are that different in the way that we live our lives out. He is very paced, and sometimes I think he's very slow. My pace is very quick, very fast. We've had to really work at listening to each other because we're listening to someone that's so different than ourselves. Let's just take a moment's break and come back to this subject of listening.
Jack and Christine will be back in just a few moments. Here's something about Jack Crabtree. Years ago, he began to seriously study the Book of Romans. So what, you say? Lots of people study the Book of Romans. Well, the more Jack studied, the more he began to see a difference between what he had always believed Christianity to be all about and what the Book of Romans was telling him. The difference bothered him, and he had to get to the bottom of it. What emerged was a fresh and insightful understanding of the gospel, an understanding that changed his life. Over the years, Jack has taught on the Book of Romans, other books of the Bible, and numerous topics. In each case, he brings his desire to get to the bottom of it. He believes that it's worth our while to seek out truth, even if it's hard work. Christine Barber is a professional marriage and family therapist. Because she works closely with people who are suffering and struggling through life's toughest problems, she has to be committed to truth. This means being committed to her clients' best interest, to their growth as wise people, and to see real change in people's lives being the work of God. For her, the answers to life's big questions are rooted in the truth of God's Word. She sees this world as the arena where God grows us up into wise people who love the things of God and look forward to His kingdom. Now, here again are Jack and Christine.
Jack, I think one of the biggest obstacles is really what you identified, is that we are threatened by what we're going to hear from the other person. I don't want to listen to the other person because it's very difficult, as we said last week, to extend myself to grow up. One of the things early on in my marriage that my husband did was help me listen to the truth. And again, we were talking about that last week. There's an example that I've given a number of times, and I think certainly you've heard it one or two times, but it was really a turning point in my relationship with my husband, where not only was he listening to me, and out of his keen ability to hear really where I was at, was he able to tell me the truth. And I think that it was only because God was creating a miracle in me that I could listen to the truth. There were many messages that were given to me, especially from high school through college, that I was a very together person. On the outside, I looked pretty together. I was pretty, had a cute little 240Z. I had enough money, my dad's credit card, to buy the things that I wanted to buy and have the clothes that I wanted to have. So it was easy on the outside to project a very together image. I think money is very helpful in helping us look pretty smooth and pretty shiny, and I certainly used it to my advantage. I was also given messages from people in my youth groups and that I was involved in through high school, and then in a careers group that I was involved in later as a young adult in college and then graduate school, that I was a very together person, that spiritually I really had the right things going, and I was doing things that I thought were right and godly, and that made me a godly person. I had my quiet times and my prayer times and my lists of memory verses and my Bible studies, and I was doing outwardly all the things that I thought and was taught to me made me a godly person. I thought I was together, and other people encouraged me that I was together. Not long after my husband and I were married, I remember sitting and talking to him and thinking that he was not appreciating me in the way that I thought he should be. I didn't think that he certainly wasn't telling me all the time how together I was, how great I was. In fact, that was pretty absent in our relationship. It wasn't absent in the way that he related to me. He related to me in a very respectful way. He was the best listener I'd ever had in my life. He was concerned about me and truly generous in his concern about me. So in my heart, I felt more loved and more valued than I ever had in my life. On the other hand, what I said to him that day was, "You know, Larry, I really don't feel appreciated by you enough, because other people in my life for the last 8 to 10 years have told me how together I am. And you know, I am a pretty together person." Now, looking back on that, I see your smirk, and you should smirk. That's an extremely arrogant thing to say. But I'd heard it a lot and come to believe it. I think it was poison to my soul in retrospect. I don't think it was. It was poison to my soul, and I had a lot of unlearning to do. But that day I started the unlearning. My husband looked at me. He quietly said, "Christine, you're not together. Nobody's together." It shot me out of the water because there was something that it touched in my heart. Everything in me didn't want to know that. And yet I knew that because he knew me, he'd seen me, he'd listened to me, that he was telling me the truth. He had a place to tell me the truth because I knew he'd listened. I think we only have a place to tell each other the truth like that. And I think it can be incredibly life-giving truth, as it was for me. All at once, I saw this poison throughout my whole soul and saw the desperate condition that I was in, needing God's grace, perhaps for the first time. And I learned that I needed God's grace more and more and more over the years, and certainly in my relationship with my husband, out of his willingness to hear me and see me and tell me the truth. He's extended himself in that way so that I'm a person who has had to, through his loving me, look at the reality of my own sinfulness. And I think that is the school that God has placed us in our marriage, both to be listeners as well as to be confronters out of our willingness to listen.
That's really touching, Christine. There's another way in which we, besides listening, I think, there's another way in which we can put our attention on the other person in the way that we need to do, and to give them the focus in our lives that we need to. I know that just by my own failure. Early in my marriage, I was involved in ministry at a relatively large church, and there are a lot of demands. I mean, a lot of people that wanted to talk to you if I would teach Sunday morning. You know, I'd have a line of maybe half a dozen people who would have questions or would want me to basically give them counsel about something that had been provoked by the teaching that morning. So, you know, after church, I may have preached the sermon and I'd have a line of six people. We had young children at the time, and my wife would have the two toddlers who were getting tired and hungry and crawling all over her and just pulling at her and tugging at her.
Fussy, demanding.
Just fussy and demanding. And, you know, to my shame, I was so completely unattentive to the really difficult position that my wife was in. I mean, it was uncomfortable. She was concerned for the children. She wanted to meet their needs. She wanted to do what she needed to do to be a mother to her children, and she was stuck at the church waiting for me to minister to the needs of these other people. And you know, I look back now and I realize how horrible it was of me to be so inattentive, to have her so much not in the focus of my attention that I would allow that to happen. I mean, my priority should have been, you know, whatever else I do, however it is that I meet the needs of these people who have these questions and have these needs, I can do that too somehow, but I need to give priority to my wife. I need to make sure that she's taken care of and facilitate her mothering our children. That should be my priority. And, you know, to my shame, it was not my priority. And it hurt her very, very deeply, wounded her tremendously. That, I mean, the message that I sent to her by my inattention was, I'm not important. Mm-hmm. I'm not valuable to her, mm-hmm. to you.
And you didn't have to say it. It was just in your behavior.
Exactly.
That, of course, she would pick that up because you weren't making her important.
Right. And it even took long hours of talking before I could even get enough perspective to see what I was doing. To see, I mean, that she would say, I'm not important to you. And I would, you know, I would come back, no, of course you're important to me. You are very important to me. And at a significant level, she was important to me. I mean, it wasn't that she wasn't, but I was abusing our relationship terribly by allowing myself at that moment in time to just be inattentive to her. And it took me a while to see that, partly because I was serving God, wasn't I, after all, and didn't she want to serve God too and support me in serving God?
Now that's a big trump
card. I could rationalize that for a while. what I realized in the end was I actually had a personality flaw, a weakness, a character weakness, where I never wanted anyone else to ever think of me as unkind and not nice. I wanted to always be nice, so if they wanted my time, I was going to be nice enough to give them my time. And I think what I really had the most trouble with is, well, Jody, don't you realize how important it is for me to be nice to people? That I had an emotional need for that. How come she couldn't get behind my emotional need for that? And
we mean, you know, how come she couldn't support your sin?
Exactly. Yeah. Why wouldn't you step in and support my weakness and let me indulge my weakness the way I want to indulge my weakness?
So I get to say, stay little and immature.
Yeah.
Basically, that was your.
And part of what she did for me in that, she did help me grow up, because part of what she did for me was to point that out to me. Is to say, you know, you're not doing it for them. You're doing it for you. That was hard to hear. But it was true. It was profoundly true. And ultimately she helped me see that. But it was hard for me. I was so blind to what I was doing.
You
I
really
so
did
thoughtless.
Not see it.
It really was hard for me to see that, yeah. Mm-hmm. But in time I did.
Mm-hmm. And what that took, again, on Jody's part, as we were saying last week, was courage and commitment to saying something that was not popular with you, and to risk the possibility of your moving away from her. You're thinking you're better than her, you're telling her in some way that she's dumb because she thinks that, in some way it would have caused a risk to her. It must have been on your part that you eventually learned to listen.
Yeah, but to my shame, it took a lot longer than it should have.
It took a lot longer because you were really, without even knowing it, gripping onto the need to be liked.
Yes, yes.
To be valued by other people.
By other people.
And yeah. To have the applause from a whole lot of people.
Exactly.
And loosening that grip often takes many years.
Yeah.
Certainly it sounds like for you it took many years.
And you know, in theory, I knew what I needed to do. I mean, I had taught the theory. The theory was that I'm to leave father and mother and cleave to my wife. That is to say, my wife needs to be the priority. If I'm going to meet anybody's needs, I need to make sure that her needs are met. It's okay for us in our marriage to reach out to other people, and indeed it would be wrong for us not to, but I should never put the needs of other people, the physical and emotional needs of other people, above the needs of my own family, and certainly not above the needs of my own wife. That's part of the commitment of marriage. That's part of the theory of marriage. That's what I'm doing. Well, I was violating that big time. I mean, I was making I was blatantly disregarding the very essence of what marriage is supposed to be, and I didn't even see it.
Well, I imagine like me, you could have stood up and even been teaching that in that one of those classes and not even seen that 2 seconds later, mm-hmm. You were violating the very thing that you were teaching.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that even happened, but I would probably teach a class on the definition of marriage, and then after the class, violate the very thing that I had just said.
Well, Jack, yeah. I think that's the extent of our blindness.
Yeah,
we just don't get it. We just don't see it. And really, the gift of our marriage comes in our spouses seeing things that we don't see and helping us look and see and grow up in them. One of the things that I'm confronted with most often in marriage is that one spouse will say of the other spouse, or both of them will say that the other guy, if only they would change, it would make my life just a whole lot better. And they can enumerate ways in which the other person needs to change. I think very often, instead of making the other person change, we really need to listen to what is being said about me and to take that in and consider it a lot. Probably consider it more than I consider anybody else in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the biggest difficulty in marriage also is what you said, Jack, that I am so much wanting to hang on to my perception of myself for me being together, for you in this example being liked, but probably both of us have overlaps in those areas. We both want to be together and we both want to be liked. We both want to be powerful in some way. We both want to be respected. There's issues that all of us share that we really want to see and have true about ourselves. It's very, very difficult for us to see that we have weaknesses or limitations. And in my effort not to see my limitation, not to see the reality of who I am, a friend of mine says, in order to maintain my cherished self-image, the image that I want to have of myself, I can, in many ways, attack and hurt my husband or wife in order to avoid seeing that. I don't know what you did in this example to avoid what Jody wanted to say to you about this issue with not making her important, but I imagine there's many ways in which you could have shamed her or hurt her or not listened to her or avoided her.
Because I recall I pouted.
You pouted?
Yeah.
You just pouted?
Yeah, I think so.
Which I think is very powerful.
Yeah.
If you say that, I think, in essence, you were saying, perhaps, I'll check this out with you, if you're going to say the truth to me, Jody, then I'm just going to pout.
Exactly. Yeah, life is not going to be comfortable for you if you tell me the truth, because I'm going to be in a bad mood.
So I'll just try to manipulate you into not saying that by pouting.
Yeah.
It obviously didn't work. Yay, Jody.
Well, I think she had to struggle with it. As you know, I not only pouted, but I also argued with her. I mean, I also tried to rationalize and make the case that you're misunderstanding me. You know, you really don't. You're attributing wrong motives to me. She wasn't. She was seeing clearly, but I didn't like the truth that she was seeing. So I tried to tell a different story about what was going on. I tried to believe it of myself for a long time, And so I think probably to a certain extent I did confuse her, you know, caused her to think, well, maybe I am not seeing this clearly, maybe I'm being unfair. And yeah, we have a lot of power over people. There's a lot of pressure we can put up on them to change the story.
Well, let me tell you a way that I'm not proud of at all about how I try to change the story. But I think I'll wait to do that. We'll have a short break and we'll come back to
in just a moment, Jack and Christine will continue their discussion on marriage. Now, I'd like to tell you something about Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a great books college. What does that mean? Well, one way to answer the question is to say that the focus of Gutenberg is reading and discussing books written by the greatest thinkers of Western civilization. Another way of answering the question is to describe what a typical day looks like for a Gutenberg student. The day begins by delving into the deep and elegant thought of the ancient Greek mathematicians. In front of his peers, and with their help, a student sorts through a carefully crafted proof penned over 2,000 years ago. Following, the students probe into the nature of written language and the study of classical Greek. It is here that he or she builds the tools for clear writing and skilled reading. Next, they learn of the rise of the Roman Empire. And throughout the week, students will hear lectures on Roman politics, art, religion, and philosophy. They will have the opportunity to ask questions during these lectures, gaining insight into the Roman state. They see how the Romans fit into the bigger picture of developing and declining cultures, which have brought us to where we are today. Then the day culminates with a discussion seminar on Virgil's Aeneid. Together, students seek to understand the story, sometimes exasperated and sometimes excited, but always engaged. After classes, informal discussions are carried on while others chat about the day's event. In the relaxed setting, a student spends a few moments getting to know an instructor. If you're interested in this kind of education, an education that focuses on growing in wisdom, listen at the end of the program for information on how you can contact Gutenberg College. And now, let's return to Jack and Christine's discussion on marriage.
Before we broke, we were talking about ways that we try to protect our weaknesses, protect ourselves from seeing our weaknesses, ways that we try to manipulate our spouses so that we don't have to see what's true about ourselves. One of the ways that you used, certainly early on in your marriage, was by pouting. In essence, you were saying, Jody, if I pout, then I'm hoping that you'll just back off and not talk to me. And you were going on to say that that really does create confusion for the person who's trying to talk to you. And certainly I think that's really a good insight, that many, many people feel very confused because they really think they saw something, they really think they want to be able to communicate that to you, but the other person is so fighting it. And we can fight it in a myriad of different ways, that it becomes confusing. Am I really seeing the truth? Now, on one hand, it's good, in a sense, to be humble enough to be taught, to be open to maybe being wrong. But on the other hand, we need, as the spouse who is being talked to, told the truth, to be very willing to see that and be open to that. One of the ways that I try to keep my husband from telling me the truth is I use anger. If I get angry enough, then he'll back down, or I'll hope that he'll back down. I use that as a way to, in a sense, threaten him emotionally. If you do this, then I am really going to come down on you. I'm going to be mean, and so you just better not tread on my feet. Earlier this hour, I was talking about a situation where Larry told me that I was not together. That was really a miracle, I think, as I said before, that it just stopped me in my tracks. Because my natural reaction is to defend my cherished self-image, often to defend it by being angry. Lots of people defend themselves by backing off. It's a very quiet thing. Pouting, for example, is very quiet. Distancing, watching TV, going off someplace, just not being willing to talk, are very quiet things. On the other hand, we can be very noisy about it, and that's my tendency, is to be very noisy about it. although I did listen to how I was not together at that point, it was a turning point for me to see. But it continued to and still continues to be a difficult area for me to continue to see that I'm not together. To continue to see the sinfulness in my own life is the number one challenge that I have, and I fail at it all the time. When I say I fail at it all the time, I'm not saying every single time. There are times when I don't fail. There are ways that certainly I am growing up and getting better at that. But I don't think I'll ever be all done with that. It will always be a challenge for me to have to see myself in the way that God sees me. And the way God sees me as a person with limitations and weaknesses, a person that needs to be changed from a person who is selfish to a person who is not.
You were commenting just a second ago about how our strategies for putting the other person off when they're trying to tell me the truth and tell me what they see can be very confusing to the other person. That's something that we have to keep in mind. I see this quite often. People in their confusion really begin to doubt their perceptions and doubt their intuitions. I think that's part of the wisdom that we need to attain to as human beings, to be wise enough to realize that other people are evil, not just myself. I'm evil, I need to know that, but I also need to know that other people are evil, and other people are out to manipulate me so that I don't tell the truth, that I don't even see the truth, and that I believe something that's not true. And I need to have the wisdom to know when somebody is doing a number on me and confusing me through their strategies, and when I'm just misperceiving, when I am wrong. Because you're right, as you suggested, we do need to be open to learning, open to the possibility that I'm misperceiving, open to the possibility that I'm wrong. But I need to be wise enough to not be manipulated into being confused when I'm actually seeing clearly.
And boy, that's, again, really, really hard work, because
yeah.
Some people can be so incredibly convincing.
Some people have actually trained themselves, have developed the ability over the lifetime to get other people to lie to them.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that I am one of the people that's very guilty of that, and I'm sad to say that, but I can be pretty fast with words. And that I can be pretty convincing to my husband that what I'm saying is right. And he always ends up kind of losing. Not always ends up losing. I don't want to say that. Leave that. He can end up losing pretty easily because he is not a person that's as fast with words as I am. We think differently. And I really need to take on and have really worked on taking on responsibility to not be that way. It's easier for me to manipulate than is not, and it's a really, really wrong thing to do, and I'm ashamed of it. Jack, I think one of the things that my husband has done to love me and to value me more than anything else is when I get angry, for him to be willing to not hurt me back. We talk a lot in the psychological world about taking responsibility for ourselves, and I think this is a really good example of that. Often it's very nebulous and hard to understand what in the world does it mean to take responsibility for myself. But he doesn't give himself the right to be angry or mean or protective or use any kind of strategies to keep himself safe in an inappropriate way when I'm angry. He doesn't say to himself most often, it's okay for me to be mean back to Christine because she was mean to me. He doesn't give himself permission to do that. He isn't making me responsible for how he feels about me being angry. In essence, he often is saying to me that by the way he responds to me is his problems are not caused by me. They are something that when he is confronted with an issue like my anger, he needs to grow up from it. He needs to use that as an opportunity to risk further growth in himself, which may mean very different things in different circumstances. But it doesn't mean avoiding the reality of what's going on because he's afraid to do anything about it.
So even if you make him feel defensive, even if your anger makes him feel defensive, he often will not deflect that onto you and say, yes, I'm feeling defensive, but it's your fault. He's willing to look at what's going on in his own reaction and take responsibility for that. That's what you're saying?
Yes, in part. I think it's a miracle that he does that. I think that he's exceptional in that way, and that's a way that I feel more valued by him probably than just about any other way. I think he's uniquely good at doing that. But, you know, this might sound like psychological jargon, but let's try and work with it. I never make him feel defensive. The reason that Larry may feel defensive from what I say is because that there's something that he needs to defend that's already in him.
Mm-hmm.
So if I, in essence, through my anger, make him feel like he's dumb, for example, well, there had to be something in him that was afraid of feeling dumb.
So that our defensiveness, if I respond to someone making me feel dumb, my defensiveness comes from really actually valuing not feeling dumb more highly than I ought to. If I really was mature, if I was really having the perspective on myself that God would want me to have on myself, I would acknowledge that, yeah, I probably do dumb things sometimes. I probably am dumb sometimes, and that's okay. That's part of what it means to be a limited, fallible, finite human being, and why do I have a problem with that?
But if it wasn't okay, then I start fighting you.
Right, right.
And I start being defensive because I don't want to hear that about myself.
Right.
And so we start this huge power struggle. We might not be talking about the issue of you feeling dumb or the core of the issue that I'm speaking to, which is afraid of seeing myself accurately, maybe that I'm not together. So we're really at an underlying level talking about me not wanting to feel not together and you not wanting to feel dumb, but we might be arguing about the dishes.
Right, right.
And what we really need to do, it's really incumbent on us to say, wait a minute, if we're having this big, huge argument about the dishes, there's something else going on under the surface that we really need to look at.
And we know that it's not about the dishes because dishes are not this important.
They're not...
So the kind of energy that I'm extending on this must not be about what doesn't deserve that kind of energy.
Well, if we're wise, we'll say dishes aren't that important. But, you know, mostly, often in our marriage, we rise dishes up to the level of that extreme importance, and it's absolutely ridiculous.
We're not self-aware enough to know that that's not the real issue.
No, and it takes years and years and years for us to say, and humility for us to say, that's not the issue. And also for me not to say, you're the issue, Jack, or Larry, who's my husband, but for me to say and ask the question over and over again, what really is the issue here with me?
Mm-hmm.
And in looking at that and being self-aware enough that I come to you and say, you know what? I think the issue is about this. I was hurting you because I was trying to defend myself against feeling weak, against feeling not together, against feeling dumb, or whatever it might be. And I was wrong to do that. Now, I may still need to talk about the issue in another way so that we can figure out how to do dishes differently. But then I'm breaking myself out of what's generating this huge fury and just talking about the issue on a much more practical level.
So you're talking about, in all of that, you're talking about the need to take responsibility for how I am responding and how I'm interacting and what's going on in me in the dynamic of the relationship. I need to take responsibility for that, be willing to be self-aware, be willing to take a look at that. Talk about forgiveness as a part of this and about forgiveness and its place in loving in the marriage relationship.
Well, Jack, you know, forgiveness is such a big subject that I think we'll be able to start it here today and probably not end it here. And I'd hate for us to think that we're going to cover it all and people to think that we've said it all. I mentioned to you last time we met that I went to a workshop for counselors. And one of the areas that they were covering was forgiveness. And they were asking the audience, what really keeps us from forgiving? And I raised my hand and I said, I think the reason I can't forgive a lot or I don't forgive a lot is because I have an inaccurate perception of myself. I don't perceive myself in need of as much forgiveness as you're in need of. Now, that fell deadpan on the person that was teaching the seminar. I'm certain that they did not agree with me. But I'm also really convinced from a biblical perspective that that really is where forgiveness comes from. I can forgive you because I see my own need for forgiveness. In this situation that we just talked about, if my husband was to come to me and say, you know what, bottom line, I got hooked into this argument, I defended myself because I was afraid of feeling dumb, then I need to decide as a recipient of that if I'm going to forgive him, because he may have hurt me by the words or the attitude that he expressed toward me during our confrontation. If I can see and look at the fact that I was indeed doing the same thing, I was defending myself, protecting myself from what I didn't want to see about myself, I can then recognize that I'm in as big of need of forgiveness as he is, and can truly and honestly from my heart extend forgiveness to him.
You will extend mercy to him because you realize you need mercy yourself.
I need it.
You are just as culpable and just as guilty as he is, therefore mm-hmm. you can't very well deny mercy of him and yet want to receive it from God.
Mm-hmm. And there may be some times when it's more often that I need my husband's forgiveness, and it may be because I have just gotten angry and he has responded lovingly to me, whatever loving looks like in that situation, which we're not defining right now. But he still needs to extend forgiveness to me, recognizing that in this situation he may not have acted inappropriately, but the core of him is a person that needs forgiveness as much as the core of me. And it is out of that recognition of his need, humble recognition of his need, that he can extend forgiveness to me. Now, when we're talking about forgiveness, one of the things that is often talked about is it also includes forgetting. I don't think that forgiveness means that at all. My husband needs to forgive me, or I need to forgive him, out of a complete and full understanding of the circumstances. My forgiveness is a commitment not to hurt him back. It isn't a commitment to forget what happened.
Yeah, I think often probably that's what people mean by forget, is simply a kind of picturesque way of saying, I'm not going to hold this against you. But it can be very misleading. I agree with you. It can be very misleading because forgiveness really isn't forgiveness if I'm not looking fully into the face of what they did, how horrendous it was, how wrong it was, how cruel it was, how damnable it was, what they did to me, and yet extend mercy to the thing, knowing full well what they have done and how unworthy it is. And yet, mercy says, but I'm not going to hold that against you. I don't want you to be damned for what you did. I don't want you to be punished for what you did. I want you to be blessed by God instead, even though you have hurt me in this way. And so that, I think that's what you're talking about, that we're not denying the fact of what took place. We are not denying the gravity of what they have done. We are actually acknowledging the gravity of what they have done, but we don't want them to be punished for it. If that's forgiveness.
And at the same time, it might require some change in my behavior. Even though, for example, my husband forgives me over and over again for my anger, I need to work very hard at not being an angry person. I need to change. I need to take seriously what it means to love my husband and work at, over the years, being less and less that way.
So his forgiving you is not
excusing
your behavior. It's not. I can't use that as saying, well, he'll forgive me, so it's okay. It's not okay. His forgiving you is an act of mercy, not an act of support for your weaknesses.
Mm-hmm. And that's another way that we take responsibility for ourselves, is we look at what's true about ourselves and we face into it and decide that we don't want to be that way, that we want to beseech God to help us change and to use whatever resources we have to make those changes. And again, one of our biggest resources is our spouse. I think this whole area of forgiveness can be very confusing. When I decide not to hurt somebody back, or when I decide to forgive them, it often means to people that I don't tell them the truth. And that's not true at all. For example, a number of women have come to me for counsel who have had husbands who have been unfaithful to them, either with having an affair with another woman or through their extensive use of pornography or fantasy, those kinds of things tend to be very big issues in people's lives. And what when they have gone to Christian counsel, what their counsel has been is just forgive your husband. And in one sense, they're absolutely right. They need to not hold that against them and hurt their husbands with the knowledge that they have. On the other hand, forgiving them does not mean making some very wise and thoughtful decisions about how they're going to enter into their relationship.
How they're going to interact with this moral failure on the part of their husband, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
If they're going to ask their husband, for example, to go with them for counsel. If they're going to look at their participation in the marriage failing. If they're going to perhaps, out of severe circumstances, decide to spend some time apart for a while. If they're going to bring that up and talk about it in such a way that they're having their whole sense of well-being might be threatened or their marriage may end because they're not willing to just sit idly by and say it's okay that you do this. I'll forgive you. I won't say you're morally less than me. That would not be forgiveness. But say we're morally actually on the same level and this behavior needs to be addressed.
So in other words, what you're saying is we can fall into the fallacious view that forgiveness is somehow going on with my life, pretending like there was no moral failure, pretending like there was no abuse or any cruelty or whatever, but that's wrong. Forgiveness does not pretend like it didn't happen. It knows it happens, and it deals with the reality and the truth of the sin and the evil for what it is, but it doesn't want the other person to have to be punished. It's willing to... I really want them to be blessed as a person, not to be cursed and damned for it, but we still have a problem and we need to address it in a wise and discerning way.
Absolutely.
Stay tuned. In just a moment, Jack and Christine will conclude today's discussion on marriage. Over the years, a lot of people have come through McKenzie Study Center. Some have come to study biblical interpretation. Some come to focus on applying the truth of the Bible to the world we live in. And others come for the great Bible teaching. And still others come because they need a place to think about their faith. What is McKenzie? It's a group of people who take the Bible seriously, who see the goal of this life as the pursuit of righteousness and wisdom, who see the gospel as the most profound message in all of human history. The McKenzie staff members have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of knowing the truth contained in the Bible. They see the need to get back to the Bible as more important than ever in this darkening world. Getting back to the Bible means trying to understand what the biblical authors intended to say when they wrote the Bible. And this can be hard work. The scriptures are often difficult to interpret and understand. Sometimes the Bible doesn't always say what we want it to say. But if we are to come to understand this world and our place in it from God's perspective, then the hard work of biblical interpretation is worth it. This is the passion motivating the staff and families of McKenzie Study Center. If you are interested in knowing more about McKenzie, we'll give you information on how to contact us at the end of the program. Then when you do, you might ask for some of our News and Views articles, such as Forgiveness, The Parable of the Unforgiving Servant by Ron Julian. In this article, Ron takes a close look at Christ's statement that if we don't forgive, we will not be forgiven. Ron's conclusion is that Christ meant exactly what he said. God's people know that they are sinners, and only the mercy of God stands between them and their deserved destruction. It is this humility without which no one can come to the cross of Christ, which results in forgiving others. Ron argues that Jesus makes this point most forcefully in the parable of the unforgiving servant. Or you might want to read Jack Crabtree's Believing Without Seeing, First Reflections on Thomas. In this article, Jack argues that doubting Thomas has received a bum rap. Thomas merely demanded the same evidence of God's resurrection that the other disciples had received. Jack states, in the unfolding of the historical events, Thomas and no one else explicitly articulates what evidence he requires in order to believe. Jack goes on to say that this story highlights the extraordinary hurdle that exists for most people, for people like you and me, to come to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Then he personally concludes, "I believe in the resurrection of Jesus, most importantly, because it makes so much sense in the light of everything I have come to understand and know about myself, about God, and about life in general." Again, at the end of the program, we'll give you information on how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center. Now, here are Jack and Christine as they conclude today's discussion on marriage.
So, Jack, again today we talked about what makes a good marriage. One of the things that we started with is what makes a good marriage is my willingness to listen. One of the largest obstacles, however, in listening is that oftentimes when I listen, I'll hear things that are threatening to me or difficult for me. We used examples in our own lives about things that we don't want to hear and yet absolutely need to. And in fact, listening to those things that our spouses say to us help us grow up, help us to become men and women who are wiser. And I think also much more humbled. Often I feel kind of saddened by what I have to hear about myself. But I think saddened is a good response to the reality of the sin in my life. Certainly it's better than using some strategy to manipulate my husband so I don't have to hear what he has to say.
And along with that, we talked about the need to, when I react and respond to the truth that I don't like to hear, it includes my taking responsibility for my reaction. I need to take responsibility for what's going on in me and not use the strategy of thinking to myself that it's my spouse's fault. They're making me uncomfortable. They're bringing conflict into our marriage, and blame them for doing that, but recognize the role that I play in my response.
And then we went on to talk about forgiveness. What role does forgiveness have in our relationship with each other? It has a really huge role. I need to forgive all the time, but my forgiveness isn't based on my being better than and bestowing something on you because I'm in a righteous position to do that. Rather, it's understanding that I'm a person that is in as much need of forgiveness as you, and that out of that essential awareness of who I am, my need for forgiveness, my need for mercy, I extend it to you.
And it was important, I think, that we understand that forgiveness is about acknowledging what has gone on and deciding to extend mercy toward it rather than wishing them damnation and punishment. But forgiveness is not pretending like something didn't happen. It's not really forgiveness at all if we pretend that it didn't happen. It's rather some kind of psychological trick of denial, which is not at all the same thing. Forgiveness is a virtue. Denial is foolishness.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you enjoy surfing the net, look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write that down, the information will be repeated in just a moment. The staff of McKenzie Study Center is dedicated to pursuing wisdom, growing in love, and understanding God's Word. And they invite you to join with them through listening to the program, attending any of the classes or seminars, or reading their articles and papers. However, the staff of McKenzie also believes that their teaching and dialogue stand in deep need of God's mercy. They trust God that their ministry will be valuable to others. The McKenzie Study Center is also a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. Again, if you would like to know more about the McKenzie Study Center, its tapes, articles, or you would like a copy of this program, please call us at area code 541-485-4801. Again, 541-485-4801. Or write to us at Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. Now, on behalf of the staff and community of the Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.